I think so many thoughts there, but even the homogeneity of Utah and just how inexperienced people are and not exposed to different points of view or cultures or ways of living, I think is problematic. And it's not really just Utah, it's the United States. I can't tell you how many people I've met who have said, I've never left the country. I'm like, you need to go experience the world and just realize that your county or town or city, whatever, is not representative of the world.
Welcome to the First Transition Podcast. In this episode and the one that will follow, I have a real talk conversation with extremely talented industrial designer Spencer Nugent. We talk about his career as a Black industrial designer. Spencer sees himself above all as a creative and an instructor who enjoys sharing his skills and process with tens of thousands of avid designers ready to learn. His online platforms have drawn over 100,000 followers from all over the world. In the following episode, Spencer opens up and shares very personal experiences to help the listeners understand what he had to overcome in order to fully embrace his Blackness after leaving a church that believed that God favors the white, fair, and delightsome. See 2 Nephi 5:21 in the Book of Mormon. He shares with us how he overcame this belief he had internalized since he was a child. Spencer was born and raised in Jamaica and moved to the U.S. as a teen. He currently lives in a community in Utah where he is a double minority, being Black and non-Mormon. His two young boys are his pride and joy. Spencer also appreciates having close family members living nearby. I hope that this raw, open, and honest discussion will give new perspectives to the many who may not understand such a unique life experience. I also hope that many hearts and minds will be open to new perspectives when it comes to the lived experience of a Black man in America. Thank you very, very much, Spencer, for joining me in the First Transition Podcast. I've been awaiting this moment for a while now.
Oh, thank you.
So thank you. I really mean it. Like, I'm really, really excited because I also want to have more people of color coming on my podcast. I also want to make my podcast as diverse as possible, right?
Yeah.
Do what you preach. First of all, if you want to share with us, you know, kind of who you are, your background. Who is Spencer Nugent?
So I'm a designer. I was trained as an industrial designer. I think of myself more these days as a creator and educator. So I'm utilizing my core competencies in very diverse ways, building furniture, doing interior design, product design, user experience, but also teaching visual communication primarily through sketching. So I have a few online properties that I manage, maintain, and contribute to. I got here because I think like most people, I'm a sum of all my experiences. You know, I think back to my childhood and my father, while sometimes absent because he was very active and involved in his faith, that he also was a man of science, but also creative as well. He would come home, paint, and draw. He actually took an evening program at an art college on the island of Jamaica, where I'm from.
Okay. And I was going to ask, tell us where you're from.
Yeah, so
originally.
I skipped that part. I'm from the island of Jamaica. I've been in the United States for about half my life now, a little more than half my life. And so we were a family that prided ourselves on education, educational pursuits, excellence, certainly, and being exposed to just a combination of those things, I think, led me to design. Initially, I wanted to do computer science, math, engineering, which traditionally speaking would be something that is respected, if you will, in that culture and by my family. But I decided to
lean. I mean, when you say respected, you mean like traditionally, like more conservative type of vocation, because
it's the thing your parents or even society pushes you to be a doctor, lawyer, not Indian chief, but doctor, lawyer, or engineer, or something along those lines. And so me wanting to essentially be an artist or creative person as a profession was outside of what I would consider the scope of what's typically acceptable or respected. I think that's changed now, but when I was growing up, the expectation was that I would do some hard science or something more technical. So
was there disappointment with your parents when you told them the vocation you were choosing, or were they just skeptical, or were they just
I have to hand it to them. They weren't disappointed. They were confused.
Okay.
Like, okay, so you're going to do this. All right. And I think after seeing my successes, there's been a level of respect afforded to me since then, but there was, I wouldn't say consternation, maybe concern about my path, because it was outside of what
the secure path. Where
being the career guy who picks a thing and sticks with it and is working for one company for 20 or 30 years and then retires. You know, that was kind of what the expectation was. And so being
that's your dad you're talking about,
like, yeah,
he was this kind of guy.
I think he worked for two companies, if I recall, and granted, I'm the youngest of five children, so I don't have a full view of
what happened before
my parents. And that being said, not only the youngest, but you know, my mom was, I think, 42 when she had me, 41, 42. So my childhood was a lot different than the childhood of my siblings and so forth. But I think I recall, my father worked for two companies.
Wow. So you just gave me another of our similarities that we have, which is totally crazy. So my mom had her, I'm the youngest of five, and my mom had her at 40.
Oh no, wow. So that's interesting.
That is really, really crazy. So, but I want to
my siblings like to say that I was spoiled, but
you know, the younger kids is always we get the slack.
They're just jealous though. They're just jealous. My family, like I said, education was always stressed. That was a big part of my childhood. So we always excelled at everything we did. And I think that work ethic, that mindset has translated itself into my design and artistic pursuits, such that I do hold myself to a high standard. I do, you know, maybe this is good, maybe not, but I do put a lot of pressure on myself to just always be my best and do the best at whatever I do. So that's kind of helped me build a presence for myself online. I had the idea in 2008 to start teaching online. So I started a YouTube channel and a website, and for much of the last decade or so, it's been a hobby. Until recently, I was working for a variety of companies as a consultant, or I had my own design firm at one point, working in a corporate environment as well, and then ultimately decided, you know, it's time to invest in myself. So I took the leap and left the, you know, cushy corporate job that I had, since then have just been betting on myself every day to do what I'm passionate about and let the rest fall into place. Yeah, it's happening. For a while there, I was having panic attacks every Tuesday about paying my bills, but
I have to say to for the listeners, you know, if you get a chance, you know, whether you are a sketcher, you know, designer, whatnot, but just go check his website, check his YouTube channel, because it's really impressive. I mean, you are like my drawing ability probably stopped at about first grade, so I'm like completely like the way, because I went this morning and was watching you doing the
the roulette wheel. Yes,
the roulette wheel. Okay, yeah. And the way you were, you know, just for practice, drawing those straight lines, I'm like, how in the world does he do that? Like, I kid you not. Like, before you zoomed the camera on your hand, I thought you had a ruler under your arm or something to make those lines straight. I'm like, can make such a straight line and just ongoing, not just, you know, it's not just like a, I lucked out on that one. I mean, seriously, if I tried to do that, you would just laugh because they would all be wiggly, my lines. They would just all
like, I like to draw parallels between my creative pursuits and lessons I've learned in life. And when I do that line exercise, if you guys check out the YouTube or my website, I talk about this idea of drawing a straight line is about creating two fixed points and then not focusing on where you start, but where you're going. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot like life. You know, when you set goals, you visualize where you want to be and that's going to drive you there. It's the same thing with drawing a straight line. And certainly consistent practice over time helps you get better at whatever it is you're doing. I do believe whether it's positive or negative things, the more you do something, the better you get at it.
Sure. So, do you have students that then from those videos and whatnot that, you know, reach out to you and say, hey, I need help with this and that. Can you, you know, give me private lessons or?
I do. Yeah, I do tutoring. That's one thing I've started doing lately. So I have a few students and then that's all done remotely. I also I also conduct workshops. So if a company or educational institution is interested in leveling up their visual communication skill set, I consult and share best practices and thoughts and techniques about how to sketch and draw. I believe you can draw anything, I believe, if you understand why certain things are the certain way.
Right. And isn't that how everything starts? I mean, as far as like the physical things we see around us, whether it's, you know, a high rise or if it's, like you say, furniture or anything that we have, or a chair. I mean, everything starts with a sketch, right?
Yeah, I believe so. That between the thought that you have in your head and the final product or the thing is a sketch.
And that
happens in different ways. It could be on a napkin. It could be something more involved on a piece of paper or digital. But at some point, you know, you can pack a lot of information into a visual concept when you draw or sketch it out. As opposed to me writing an entire essay about the object, you can really concisely and effectively communicate your ideas and thoughts and connect on an emotional level almost sometimes when you are good at executing those drawings. So yes, I believe most things in life that we encounter have started with some sort of sketch or another.
So I could talk about this for a long time and we might actually do that, you know, on a follow-up podcast because I always have a ton of questions. I think it's really fantastic what you do. And so at what point did you kind of see that you had a gift, or did you ever see it that way? Or was it always for you, no, I worked on this, I wasn't good at the beginning and I developed this? Or did you at some point I really enjoy this. I think I'm gifted and this is where I'm going to go. Like, when did that come?
It's interesting. I was chatting with a friend from college today and we were talking about me being in the design program at the time. So I went to Brigham Young University in Utah. That's where I studied design. But as I studied, I was very insecure, not very confident about my skills and abilities. So your question about when I realized it wasn't so much realizing as it was accepting that I was good. I knew I always had an aptitude for it. As a child, I knew that visual things just appealed and spoke to me. I knew that I had the ability to dissect something in a way that could reveal its functionality or purpose in the world, and I could manipulate those parts, which is kind of what creativity is about. It's making those connections that you might find between seemingly disparate things and then coming up with something additive that's cumulatively better than the initial premise of those two things.
Right.
And that's a simple example, but I realized I had that skill set at an early, early age. As far as believing in myself, though, it took and maybe this is a good segue, it took me disbelieving in a few things to then start to believe in myself and vote in confidence in my abilities, skills, and who I was and what I had to offer to the world.
Awesome. And yes, this is a great segue, and we can just quickly go into, you know, you did mention that you studied at BYU. So if you could maybe tell our listener, what was your relationship with the LDS Church, you know, and then when you left. And I will also put the links to the full stories on, you know, Mormon stories. I'll put the link in the notes as well.
So I grew up, like I mentioned, on the island of Jamaica in the Caribbean, or as I like to say, Caribbean. That's how we say it, Caribbean. Mm-hmm. I need to speak with my accent more. But anyhow.
Well, I will ask you at some point. I'll wait for, or whenever you feel like it. But I think it would be great to hear you speak with the native accent. I do believe that accents are like spices in the world, right? We may not like everything, but they definitely add flavor.
That's definitely true. I mean, usually you hear it come out every now and then as I'm speaking, I grew up in Jamaica. I knew nothing differently than Mormonism, or the faith that's now known as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I was born in it, youngest of five children, born into it, didn't know anything different. And like you said, you can hear the full story at the links you're providing. But I knew nothing different. I just thought Mormonism was my world, and that's all I knew. So for my family, the trajectory of our educational pursuit was going to culminate with us attending BYU, Brigham Young University in Utah, at some point. And that is the school that's owned by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints here in Utah, where I still live. And although I did escape Utah, and, you know, Utah is a way of pulling you back, if you will. So, I went to BYU. I was Mormon. I was a quote unquote good Mormon boy. Didn't, at least outwardly, I will say, I didn't outwardly rebel. Inwardly, I was rebelling. I would happily do things in secret, but not reveal said things, because there's a certain element of Mormonism that involves keeping up appearances,
and involves very much so
putting forward your best self at the in interest of wanting to fit in and be accepted by the greater community. Community is fundamentally just such a strong part of what I would consider to be traditional Mormonism. And if you don't conform, the threat would be that you are effectively shunned or treated as an outsider. And so that fear kept me in line, certainly. But I was grateful for my education at BYU. It was affordable. It was effective. That being said, there were probably, I would say, more conditional or related to the location of the school and the general population incidents, things that I didn't particularly like. But my education itself, I thought, was great. Like, I had largely no issue with the things I was taught. I do wish I had been able to skip all those religion credits,
or
gotten a minor in computer science instead.
Right. But a lot of people coming out do realize that. I mean, of course, maybe it serves, I think it serves them more than it serves even for people that are still members. It doesn't serve you, because you already spend 3 hours at church every Sunday, and could use your academics for, you know, more useful knowledge than what they're you know, exactly, forced you to have to graduate. So I think a lot of people realize that.
And for those who don't know, Brigham Young University, based in Utah, is not a very diverse school, so. My community, in effect, was my family. We immigrated here in the year 2000. It was me and my parents. My siblings had all attended school here prior to me arriving. And so, yeah, I was the youngest, and it was time to move. So we decided to immigrate to the United States, and we did. almost 2 decades ago.
Yeah, it's interesting because at the time you moved in from Jamaica, I was starting at BYU. You started a year after I graduated. So you, if my notes are correct, you started in 2004 at BYU?
I did, yes. So I started technically 2003, but...
Okay. Yeah, well, I graduated end of 2003, so we just barely...
okay. Yeah, I started, I believe, winter 2003.
Yeah, so I left winter of 2003. That's really funny. Okay, go ahead. What were you going to say?
Oh, I was just going to say, I don't know if you were part of the Black Student Union at the time, but
now that I think of it, we definitely would have crossed paths, but you were a freshman, right, when you started?
Yeah, well, technically a freshman in my program, but I had completed some studies at UVU, which is another college here, Utah Valley University.
No, I went there too, which is funny. I started this.
Okay, we'll have semester. To talk offline and see if we know some of the same people.
Well, I started at BYU's summer program, then I went to UVU so I could just like rack all the prereqs super fast, and then I went back. So I basically, you know, I did 4 years in 3 years, but because I could, you know, I doubled up my class. I had a year in Belgium before coming to Utah to BYU. So, but I also did the UVU thing where I just kind of racked up all my prereqs and whatnot, or the first classes you need, the general classes, and then went for my I did international relations and political science over there.
I don't know how the educational system is in Belgium, but I remember coming here from Jamaica and thinking this is really easy. We prided ourselves on educational excellence, and I just remember having that feeling of, you know, man, these kids, they don't know what they have, and why are people not working harder? This is too easy.
Yeah, same feeling. At least the first, you know.
The first year for me was easy.
That's why I was able to pretty much do 2 years in one almost at UVU.
My first year felt like my last year of high school is what it felt like.
Yeah, exactly. So, exactly. So I think, I think coming from a foreign developed country, I think most people, you know, you talk to Asians or whatever, like it's kind of the same. So, but yeah, there you go. One more common thing we have.
Yeah.
So did you feel when I went to BYU, I felt like I was giving extra attention. Like, I mean, people were super nice, and it was almost because I was the minority, people wanted to make sure I felt welcome, and, you know, that's how I feel. And I don't know if it's different because I'm a girl or what, because I have heard different stories from different people, but at least my professor and even the student, I mean, some, you know, most students probably didn't care, but a lot of people, especially the professor, were kind of going out of their way to be nicer to me, I would say. So I'm like, yeah, okay, you know, whatever.
You touched on an interesting topic. I think one of my ongoing feelings is I want to not feel seen, but I know that's not necessarily a rational thought. It's just, I think,
but people make you remember that you're different.
People make you remember you're Black. Nice or not. I remember the first time I realized I was Black, right? I moved to Utah, had some experiences with covert white supremacy, you could say, or maybe it was even more overt, but wow. I remember being in my room and just thinking, wow, I am Black.
So
in Jamaica, everyone is Black, not everyone, right? But, you know, 90%.
Yeah, well, of course it's a country with
brown people. Was it I tell a few stories in a few other podcasts and links that I shared, but this one I haven't told, so I will share this one. I've always been a tech gadget guy. I love gadgets, trinkets, and all that stuff. So there was a store in Utah. I don't think it's even in business anymore, so I'll just name drop. It was called Ultimate Electronics. I don't know if you remember that place. But
I don't think so. I was not a techie person.
I went in because I think I needed a hard drive. I don't remember what I needed. But I went in, And I wasn't dressed in any way that I wouldn't have been dressed otherwise at home in Jamaica. Mm. But clearly, because of the way I was dressed, I was ignored. Mm. Not only ignored, but treated with some suspicion and mm. I would maybe describe as derision. So that was perceptual on my part. There weren't necessarily words exchanged, but I was able to observe certain people.
Yeah, you can tell and feel the looks and the... I know what you mean. I know what you're talking about.
There were people that were getting help and I wasn't, and I was frustrated, you know?
Yeah, because they were getting ahead of you or something.
Yeah, they would get ahead of me or, you know, hey, mm-hmm. hello, sir, how are you doing? Mm-hmm, you know, they would mm-hmm. get the treatment. And I wasn't necessarily super confident and comfortable at the time. So I didn't
speak up. How old were you?
I was 18 at this point. I didn't speak up, but okay. I will say what I realized was that maybe I needed to change a variable here. There's my math brain going off. That's what I was studying at the time when I came to the US. I was studying math and then I went to
okay.
So I was thinking, okay, let's change the variable here. Let me, and this is, it's so funny to even think now. I went home and I got my nicest suit and I cleaned up and I went into the store and almost immediately, hello, sir, you know, how can I help you? So it wasn't that I was a different person, but because of my appearance, which at the time was no different than many people in the store who were getting treated. Right, I changed that one variable and all of a sudden I was taken seriously. So to me, that taught me that as a Black person in Utah or as a person in Utah, one, I'm different, right? And that just hit me. And I remember just feeling like, wow, you are Black. But two, it reminded me that I have to work twice as hard.
Yes, to get what the people get basically.
Yeah.
That, to get the basics.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
That's horrible. Yeah.
So that was one of the experiences. There were other experiences as well.
Yeah. And I wonder, I think mine, you know, I must say, you know, I had incredible friends, very open-minded, maybe also what I was studying, you know, international relations, people were kind of automatically kind of more open-minded. My professor were all liberals, which we were like the small group, you know, like we were the oddball a little bit, you know, like it was all before 9/11, like, right. I mean, I was actually at UVSC. It was UVSC at the time.
I was at UVU.
UVSC
when 9/11 happened. I was in a computer lab, I remember.
Okay, so I was there too. So I was at, because in 11, wait, 2001, right? 2001.
Yep, 2001.
Yes, I was there. Interesting. But then after that, you know, with the whole war in Iraq and whatnot, like, our department was against it. The whole, you know, all the Republicans, of course, were pro-war and we were against. And we had so many reasons because we knew about the Middle East. We knew about, you know, like we were studying the region. So anyways. You know,
I'm gonna transition here to something because you mentioned
that
you weren't Republican, but I'm not sure if you grew up Mormon, but you were Mormon. I remember.
I did.
Oh, okay. I remember being Mormon and oft times I would have these feelings of disagreement with myself, or I guess
cognitive dissonance
with my morals and ethics, but I was complicit and happy to listen to Rush Law and Sean.
Oh, Hattie wow. And, yeah.
Because that's what my parents would listen to. And that's what they would teach me. And so,
because you didn't know better and you were basically, you were conforming, even subconsciously, you were conforming.
I mean, I was a 20s when I got married, divorced now, but when I got married, I was 26 years old and a virgin, you know, just like,
yes. Well, yeah.
And at the time I didn't think that was weird, but outside of Mormonism, that is different.
Yeah, no, that was me too, because as far as, like, you know, Word of Wisdom, you know, Law of Chastity and all that, I was following everything to a T, but with maybe my worldview, right? I was already, you know, I grew up in a socialist country. So coming here, I did not let down of that. Like, I just, you know, and studying political science and international relations, my worldview was always international. Like, I've always had that. So
I attribute it to Mormonism, again, the faith I grew up in, being essentially a vehicle for imperialism and colonization, in the sense that Mormonism does not make room for cultural accommodations in its ideology. It's a faith that comes to you or is presented to you,
and you have to fit in the box, whether you're from, you know, Tonga or, you know, France, exactly. or whatever. They exactly. want you to like come and fit in that box. Yeah.
And I knew no differently. You know, my siblings and I, we talk about this idea from time to time. I won't name them. Mm-hmm. I won't out them. But this idea of like, sometimes growing up, we felt white inside. Okay. So what I mean is just our aspirations or things or ideals or mindsets or goals and dreams were often aligned with this white ideal. There was almost a disdain even for our own culture and our own traditions and our own way of doing things.
Interesting.
Because we knew no differently. So embracing my blackness has been a process that's taken over the last 5 or so, maybe 7 years, to where, you know, even
since you left the church, or did it start?
Yeah, that's when it accelerated. For sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. After I shed that belief system and structure was part of answering those questions of, okay, who am I?
Yes.
Who am I really at my core? And what is my culture?
It's
not something I'm proud to say, but it's something I'm working on is even in my design pursuits. Okay. What does it mean to be a black designer? Is that different than being a designer in general?
Yes. Yeah.
What does it mean for me to be a black father? Not just a father, but what does this mean?
Yeah. It's interesting. In a way, I think I want to argue that it's because we live here, you live here, because in the same way you're like, oh, I realized, you know, I was black, like, in that, you know, that when I had that experience in that store and whatnot, for me it was the same, but it's not even Mormonism per se. It's coming to the US, because I grew up as a minority. I mean, in Belgium there's less black people, I want to say, than here. Like, it's even you have a few, you know, a lot of Congolese, because of the, you know, the Congo was a Belgian colony. That's where my ancestry is also from, which there is also horror stories on that side. But the people who live in Belgium and the way I grew up and everything else, I mean, color was never like in the talks, or, I mean, it's like, you know, eye color, hair color, skin color. Like, people don't talk about that. I mean, it's just not a thing. And so it's not until I come to the U.S. And of course, you know, I'm 100% Mormon, very practicing. All my friends are white. I lived in D.C., Washington, D.C. for a year. Like, I was an exchange student, an au pair, not so much an exchange student. I didn't go to school. But and so for me, you know, I'm an active member. Of course, I do realize there is only 3 of me in this singles ward of like 300 people. I do notice that.
3, that's nice, because from my experience, I was usually the only one.
And so it is a bit odd, but because I am so integrated in the faith, you know, and people are super nice and whatnot, like, it doesn't really bother me at first. Like, in fact, it didn't bother me.
People that see me as a Negro. They don't see me as a Jamaican. And I use that word intentionally because it makes people uncomfortable. Mm-hmm, but I'm no different. And that's what, when I say I realized I was black, I realized I was no different than everyone else here, right? I had to drop this idea that because I grew up, I remember thinking, why are you guys all so angsty and have issues, and even saying you guys, or why do they?
Yes.
Sort of a me and them. Like, I'm not that
so
way.
That is something I also wanted to kind of, I'm glad you bring it up, because as a non-African American, we go through our own set of struggles as well, because I was beat up, you know, online by, you know, African Americans, and I love everyone. Like, that's the thing. Like, and I get, you know, the struggle at some level. I will never even pretend to understand it the way, you know, because I'm not African American. Like, and I always say that, you know, when I come with what I say and my opinions, whatnot, I get that I don't get the full picture. I'm still learning about the history, about the culture, about the everything. I'm still learning, even though I've lived here now for nearly 20 years. But so we have to really navigate two different things here, because it's like, okay, for, you know, white folks, we're just the black people, right? Yeah. For the white folks. But for African Americans, we don't quite get it. So there's this kind of belittlement sometimes that I have a hard time with, because it's like, I get that I don't get the full picture, but you don't, mm-hmm. You also don't have the right to belittle my experience because I don't have your exact experience. And I have felt a lot of belittlement, even in some of the forums. I got kicked out of forums because I was saying things like, I get that, you know, some people need to listen more than share their opinions, but I also come from a culture where people can all say what they think. They can all participate. You don't just shut down, you know, people and kind of, it to me, it's bullying, you know, like you have to leave the door open for communication, even if, you know, whether you think you're talking to your oppressor or whatever, like nothing gets accomplished if one is always shutting down the other in order to like say what you think or what you feel.
I think so many thoughts there, but even the homogeneity of Utah and just how inexperienced people are and not exposed to different points of view or cultures or ways of living, I think is problematic. And it's not really just Utah, it's the United States. I can't tell you how many people I've met who have said, I've never left the country. I'm like, you need to go experience the world and just realize that your county or town or city, whatever, is not representative of the world. There are many great and wonderful people doing amazing things that may not ideologically
stuff. And some people may not have the opportunity to, the chance to, but I also think there is a desire, because I came in the US on my own free will. My mom didn't pay for me. We didn't have a lot of money. It's like I've always had that desire, you know, discover the world, discover what's out there. And some people do and some people don't. And some people will never get a chance, whether it's because they don't have the finance or whatever. But you should still be curious, even if you can go, you know, because you don't have the means and now there is Corona, you can't fly places. But be curious about the world, because that alone will open your mind, right?
Yeah.
And get a chance to travel. But a lot of people are not curious enough, in my opinion. It would be really hard.
Utah. So I used to live in Utah County. And for those who don't know, Utah County is, I would probably just hazarding a guess, maybe 70 to 80% Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting area to be in because of just how close-minded people are. But yeah, Salt Lake's definitely more liberal and more open-minded for sure. And I do believe that you make the best of whatever circumstances you're in.
Yes.
I have a friend and he told me something that was impactful and I think made me want to stay even more.
Mm.
And that is, diversity has to begin somewhere.
Yeah, that's true. You know, and if you're the only one that they all get to, you know, come in contact with, and that opens their worldview.
Yeah, there was a diaspora, if you will, after slavery in the United States, where, or rather the emancipation of slaves, that people just went to different places. And, and you know, in a sense, in a way, being here in Utah is me saying, hey, you know, I'm here, what you gonna do
yes.
about it?
Yes, no, it's probably good, because if you're never exposed at all, you know, you may be that one sole person that, you know, many come in contact with, you know, I hope not, but that could be, and that's a positive way to see things, especially, and I agree with you. I mean, we both live in red states. I live in Texas, so. You know,
that's actually where I served an LDS mission for the Mormon Church. Where were you? In Austin and San Antonio.
How was it?
It was good. I encountered some of the most racist people I have in my entire life there. But
wow.
Also, it was a good experience and lesson in hard work, discipline, consistency, routine, all those things. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, I do believe there's, I mean, I've had, when I first lived here, so my ex-husband is from Texas, and we came back after BYU, moved to Houston. He went to law school there, and we lived there for about 5 years. And at that point, we're still both super Mormon. And so, you know, when you are, you just kind of in your ward with your people, you're in the bubble, and yeah. Everything was just wonderful because, you know, I'm a pretty outgoing person. I make friends easily, you know, everything was fine. And then we moved to Switzerland for 7 years and then came back. And that second time around is a different story because that's where the whole face transition happens. We both leave, you know, things go super south with the ward where I go maybe a couple of times and it's just over.
I appreciate you sharing, just to give a bit of context. Yeah, I married into a very Mormon family.
Mm-hmm.
My now ex is, happily remarried to a woman. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my divorce was somewhat high conflict, you could say.
Mm.
Not as high conflict as others, but in the same time, I mean, I'm maybe a little bit jealous that you have that kind of relationship with your ex.
No, was it because of it that you divorced, or was it partially or not at all? Like the fact that she's a lesbian.
Oh, no. I didn't know that till 2 years almost after.
Okay. Because she didn't come out until then, or she just kept it a secret, or like.
Yeah, well, I will say this. So being Mormon, I didn't know. is this podcast PG, G? What is this?
Oh, no, it's adult. It's for adult.
I did not know what it was like.
I talk about sex all the time.
I did not know what it was like to be desired by a woman and what physiological and emotional responses that entailed because I was a virgin at 26. And so for me, I just didn't know and understand what it was like. Having left the church, being divorced, dating, and having adult interactions with responsible
humans,
I was like, wow.
Okay, this is what it's supposed to be like. Gotcha. I know what you're talking about.
You know?
Yes.
And I mean,
again, because we both have, I was too a virgin, and I married, you know, my now gay husband, who we both had no clue, right? You know, we had three kids. We had three kids, but we really... So yes, I'm pretty sure we kind of probably went through somewhat of the same journey of discovering, okay, this is what I really like. This is what it's really supposed to be like. Okay, I'm glad I get to experience this before I die. At least that was my thing.
Well, I mean, that's a positive way to look at it for sure. I didn't know at all. But, you know, that was certainly an impactful and transformative time in my life and learned a lot of lessons. And going back to what I was saying, I wish I had that relationship, but I haven't. I mean, there are times when communication was better, certainly. But,
due to what is she? Well, clearly she's not a member anymore.
Yeah, so we both left the Mormon church around the same time. I guess you could dispute who left first or who started.
Right.
Mine was, I think, a more considered and thoughtful process. I took about 18 months to just study, and really what I'm not sure if your listeners know a ton about Mormonism or not, but there are three things that impacted me. One was when I was on my mission, I actually encountered a book called The Church and the Negro, and I talk about this. But even the title of the book is just so
Very much so.
The account was, and the gist of what I read was, as a Black person, you are sinful. That's where your Blackness comes from. Your Blackness is not goodness. It's a result of sin.
Mm-hmm.
And not only sin, but murder, if you think about it, right? The brother of Abel Cain murdered. And so we are descendants of such. And
how do they even know he was Black? Like, where does that come from?
Well, the curse of darkness, whatever that is. That's Mormon doctrine. And so... Man, it's heavy because as a Black person, you are the result of sin. Like, you know, white people aren't taught that.
But aren't we all coming from Eve? If I guess, believe in the Bible.
It's not the same. Like, Eve didn't murder someone. Eve facilitated the propagation of humanity. It's actually a good thing. And they spin it as a good thing.
Oh, they spin
it as a good thing. They don't spin Cain's murder as a good thing. Hey, you know, thank God for Cain murdering Abel because we have black people. No. So that's one. And then the other is that the reason for black people. So in Mormon theology, there's this thing called the pre-existence. And in the pre-existence, the doctrine was taught that we were the ones who weren't the most righteous, if you will, the ones who were the best.
Hesitating. Should we or should we not follow Christ?
You can call it hesitating, but the message is you are not the best of the best of God's children. And because of that, you are black. So everything the Mormon church approached blackness with was not from a mindset or point of view of greatness or excellence or even being, which science has proven is the source of all human existence, you know, Africa being the cradle of civilization, but more so that we were the result of sin and poor decisions.
That's another thing. I never bought that.
That was my first fracture in my faith.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
But I was like, what the fuck is going on right now? You're telling me that this is where I came from? And my parents had kind of explained the policies of the Mormon church at the time in restricting the priesthood, which is the authority, or you could even argue the equity or even inequity, because women in the Mormon church can't participate at the level as men. That being said, even as men, we were barred from that because of who we were. And there was no changing of that at the time.
Yes, as black people,
It wasn't. So that was messed up. Anyhow.
So that was on your mission.
That was
so
my first experience.
Encounter with, like,
on my Mormon mission in Austin.
Overt racism.
No, it wasn't. I'm trying to think which... I think I was in Universal City, Texas, which is just northeast of San Antonio, but that's where I encountered that book. So that was one thing. The next was the
real. Who gave it to you?
I found it in one of the church libraries.
Back, oh yeah, that's right. I remember back when you
Mormon
saying
libraries
that.
Were good.
Right. yeah, they weren't hiding things.
Yeah, they weren't hiding things. You know, you could find Mormon doctrine, doctrines of salvation, all of the good stuff, you know.
Yep. I read them all except for that one. I didn't make it across the Atlantic, you know. So well, they only make some books come across.
I'll tell you a funny aside. So I read this book on my mission. I went into a panic because I was thinking, what am I a part of? But the reason there's like four things I'm going to talk about here. So the reason was the book taught or highlighted that Mormonism taught that as a black person, you were going to be resurrected, which means that after you die, you can come back to life if you've been good, righteous, whatever. And in that condition, you come back perfect and whole. Mm-hmm. Now, my entire life, I just assumed that, and this is what I was taught in Jamaica, that I would just come back to life as me. But what was not made clear to me was that because my blackness was a result of sin and an imperfection, blackness is not a good thing. It's an imperfection, as Mormonism is concerned. That would be scrubbed. I would be resurrected white and beautiful, they say.
So is that where that come from? Because I only heard this kind of like, you know, people saying it, you know, people said that someone said, like, I never read it with my own eyes in any books, but I heard that. But all of that stuff I always threw in the trash, like right away, like in my brain, I'm like, that's all bullshit until.
Yeah.
And just like you, I came across, you know, the anti-Mormons on Temple Square. They're always there and they're always trying to give you stuff, you know, a bunch of papers that, you know, one anti-Mormon gave it to me. He's like, what are you doing in this church? They're racist. And he gave me some stuff. And that's when I read all these quotes about, you know, Brigham Young said and McKenzie said and the Negroes and this and that. And I just went straight to my mission president. I'm like, what is this crap? And he was just so uncomfortable. He was like, I'm so sorry. You know, this is from, I tell that story in some of the podcasts, but that I never you know, believed it. I never took it in. Like, I heard some stuff, but I was like, that's all bullshit. Like, why should I believe that? You know, I kind of immediately threw it away. And I found it very hard when I heard your story that you, from the moment you little and on your mission, that you integrated that. To me, that was so, and I know you're not the only one, you know, many Black people have done that where they believed it and they integrated it and they felt lesser than. I'm like, that is so hard.
You know, there's so much to talk about. There's an element of internalized racism where you literally hate your, because you're not perfect people, or rather feeling justified in the sight of God, if you will, because mm-hmm. you're white, because again, you carry this mark of sin through no fault mm-hmm. of your own.
Yes.
That's just
yes.
where you're born.
Yeah.
And you're thought of as lesser than. So that doctrine or that idea was something that was so orthogonal and oblique to my perception of everything that it really rocked me. It rocked me. I was on my mission. I knew that my immigration status was somewhat tied to the completion of my mission or education. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. that was
you were kind of trapped. Yeah, you had to make it work.
I felt trapped. I was captive to this system, this cult, if you will, and dependent. And it took me years to just develop my own sense of independence and realize that, you know, I didn't have to be in that situation, but I was willing to hang on because, and just for a little behind the scenes logistics here, all my siblings had moved to the United States. Most of them had married or transitioned into some sort of permanent status. My parents had permanent status, but I didn't. So if I didn't comply, if I didn't finish my mission, if I didn't stay at BYU,
you could be sent back to Jamaica or something.
My entire life was at risk. So on my mission, I buried it. I shoved it under the rug or put it back on the shelf, so to speak, and I made it work. But that was a big one. That was a big deal.
Yeah, I can't imagine, because I mean, it was shocked. Like, I was shocked when I read that stuff. I wasn't just like, oh, I don't care. I was like, that's horrible that, you know, someone I view as a prophet of God would say stuff like that, you know? And then I even wrote to, at the time I could write to, you could write to the First Presidency. I wrote to President Hinckley and sent him copies of the stuff and said, hey, what is this? And, you know, of course they answered like, I got an answer and it was politically correct. You know, we don't believe this anymore. You know, listen to the current prophet and da, da, da. It wasn't an apology. It wasn't a, you know, we're sorry, but you feel bad. It was just like, you know, quoting 2 Nephi and he accepts, you know, bond and free, black and white. I mean, they always revert to that one verse when there was like a ton of others that are like super racist in the Book of Mormon. But and I also decided, because, you know, I was on my mission, I didn't internalize. I'm like, okay, fine. It's in the past. They don't think that anymore, you know, things have changed. And I was able to roll with it until, you know, after when my faith crisis research, you know, years and years later, everything comes back and I'm like, yeah, why don't they apologize? And I think that was my first op-ed, because I wrote a bunch of op-eds to the Salt Lake Tribune when I was transitioning out.
I remember that.
I wrote like 6 or 7 different op-eds on different topics, but that was the first one. And I wrote it from Switzerland because it was like the anniversary of the priesthood or something, you know, they celebrate that, yet there is never been an apology or feeling bad for people being excluded. I'm like, what is it you're celebrating? Yeah, we can't have it. But what about all the people who've been hurt by this, you know? So there was, that was the very beginning of my phasing out. But yeah, so I'm glad though that you found a way to work through it, to kind of peel it off, you know, all that negativity.
I guess I didn't speak to the way. I just somehow convinced myself that the central canon of the Mormon Church was true and worthy of me continuing my mission. That's the Book of Mormon, which is also problematic as from a racial perspective, in terms of how skin color, pigment, appearance is tied to negative things. So as a Black person, you grow up in this faith and you think that you're less than, and that's mm-hmm. bolstered and reinforced by teachings of prophets, but also the central scripture and canon. And that's a heavy, heavy thing to overcome, but yeah. Somehow I made it work. Somehow I made it work in my head and I carried on.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because it's not being preached at the pulpit, you know, for some time, you kind of put it in the back burner. You don't think about it. Like, it's easy not to think about it because it's not something you talk. I mean, now, unless you're like in the exmo and postmos forums, like, people don't talk about that in church. So it's easy to kind of pretend it's not there. Right.
Yeah, you know, you touched on a concept of apologizing, and how, you know, even though the Mormon Church has disavowed those prior teachings, words have power. And I think to mm-hmm. move on, I'm not perfect personally. I've overcome many challenges in my life. I've done shitty things, but to move on from those things, you have to, I think, acknowledge in
full. Yeah.
What you did, and
not halfway, because what they're doing is like halfway acknowledging but not fully, and that to me is so unnerving, because it's like, you know what to do, you just don't want to do it because you know the cost of it.
It's not even just acknowledging, it's like you have to own it.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. Like, they acknowledge, but they did it to me, the disavowing, it's a partial recognition, it's not a full recognition. Full recognition requires full admission of the wrong and trying to repair, which of yes. course you can't go back in and you know, bring back the people who are gone or whatever, or never got it, but you have to apologize, you have to acknowledge the pain, you have to feel sorry, which they don't seem to do any of that.
Yeah, you know? And maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here, but the Mormon Church is interesting because they have this idea of the relationship between faith, works, and ordinances, which are rituals they perform in the church to get you access to heaven, and also a means of correction, if you will, coming back into good favor with God, which is repentance. Mm-hmm. And that process right. involves a full and complete accounting of the mm-hmm. wrong you did. And I feel like with the history of the church and that moment that was so impactful to me, there has been no full accounting. And it's even mm-hmm. something that is practiced now when it comes to a woman, and not always a man, a woman who wants to remarry. Mm-hmm. So in the Mormon church, I don't know if you have friends who've experienced this.
No, I know how it works. But it's not the same standard.
When you want to marry someone else, if you've gone to the temple and have been married there, which is, again, mm-hmm. the pinnacle
the ceiling.
Of Mormonism. Mm-hmm. Yes, the ceiling. You have to present a full and complete accounting of all transgressions you've done in the time that you divorced civilly from your partner.
Which is
this time you want to remarry. I mean, it's
such control. It's triggering and traumatizing.
So when my wife or ex-wife at the time, or now, wanted to marry me, she had to, and I don't know but what it was, but she had to write a letter explaining everything she did that was...
She had been married before?
Yeah, so she was married before mm-hmm. to another
fellow. A member.
Yeah, I'm a member of the church. And so when she wanted to cancel that sealing, because as a woman, you can only be married to one man at a time, but as a man, mm-hmm. you can be married to more than one woman.
Right.
Conceptually. So to cancel that, I remember just that being an emotionally difficult time for her. And I feel mm-hmm. the pain and discomfort. I felt the pain and discomfort of that moment. But it's hypocritical of the Mormon Church to not have accounted for what they did.
To follow the same standard, like on my mission, I don't know if it was on the same with yours, but like when you talked about repentance, right, you had the ABCDs, like you admit, you know, be sorry, correct, and then do it no more. And you know,
sorry, you're gonna say deny, because that's what they do, but
do it no more, which really, even the do it no more, I mean, most of it, admit, yeah, somewhat, 50%, be sorry, not really, correct, you know, and then do it no more. It's like, even in the representation of the church, like, it's like, why not? You claim yourself to be this worldwide church. Like, why aren't apostles more diverse? You know, why Why isn't every nation represented? Because that would be a good representation. Every color, every nation. Because in 12 people, you can do it. You can really do a lot of, you know, representing the world with 12 people, but they don't seem to care enough. So, you know, they're not good enough. Like, you can't find anyone good enough in all these places. Come on.
I think you bring up an interesting point about representation and leadership and how that should be. I think that's one thing we're striving toward. For whatever outcome of the injustices that have happened lately in America, we're hoping for some more, at least I'm hoping for more equity and representation at the right levels, certainly. Mm. That is, at the very least, representative of a demographic breakdown of reality. Mm-hmm. But the Mormon Church, for whatever reason, you know, they have huge footholds in countries like Africa, or not countries, sorry, continents like Africa.
Yes, South America.
And the countries there, yes, in the continent of South America and those countries, but at the highest levels of leadership, you're not seeing you know, that representation. Especially, and it's especially messed up because these people are asked to sacrifice and pay
their culture. Also, I want to go back a little bit in what you were saying with, you know, the Book of Mormon and the representation. I mean, think of, you know, and how bad you felt, but think of, you know, a lot of the people from South America and Central America. Like, I have learned so much because, of course, I wasn't close to a lot of people, at least not in Belgium. And then, you know, how they gobble these stories about supposedly their people who don't even never existed. Mm-hmm. And they are taking that, you know, lemonized, you know, bad guys and skin color. They're taking that like at face value, and it's all freaking bullshit. How audacious. And I mean, I can't now, the more I think about it, the more I'm just completely disgusted of how you're making people who have their own culture, their own history, their own real, you know, DNA proven, you know, background, you're making them forget about all that, put a crust on that, and believe this, what is in this fictional book, because this is where your people come from. I mean, you know, Sarah Newcomb and all the work that she's done, and the hurt that these people go through, they're just a bit, they're sometimes quieter than we are, but I mean, as Black people, we're louder. But I mean, the hurt and the pain, it is just unfathomable.
I mean,
and the fact that they're not trying to change this now that clearly DNA evidence is clearly not there. And they've even recognized that themselves. Church approved publications. There is no DNA evidence. Why do you make people believe fictional, hurtful stories about their own people and denying their own culture? How wrong is that?
I can't speak to the why. It's something I've pondered and thought about, ponderized, if you will, for a long time. You know, clearly, like you said, science, facts, so much evidence is...
Everything denotes against. It's not true.
Yeah.
Everything under heaven denotes it's not true, to speak Mormon.
Yeah, it's an interesting
thought. Go ponderize about that.
I don't know why, but I try to always be a bit accommodating for different points of view and recognize that the Mormon Church does have some value for people. And there are some good things about, I would say at a very high level, the principles they're in, but there's also so much harm and damage that's been done, particularly to Black and Indigenous peoples of culture or minorities, or you look at, and this is another reason I left in November 2015, when the policy that essentially was punishing children of gay parents specifically. Mm-hmm. I remember sitting with my ex-wife at the time and thinking, what are we doing? What is this? Mm. We were about to cut a large check to the church for tithing. We had a business. Mm. would pay annually is what we would do after expenses. It's a very large check, five-figure sum, you know, and I'm sitting there thinking, what do we want to pay this? And the answer was a clear no. And what was interesting is that I was teaching at BYU at the time as an adjunct faculty. And that was also difficult. You know, it was difficult to, at the same time, you know, kind of like I said at the beginning, as a creator and educator, something I value a lot, being able to teach and share my knowledge, and just feeling so conflicted about being a part of this organization. And that's not to say I'm not willing to help them still, but even today, which is interesting, I have, like I mentioned, a large following online, and I'm respected in my circles, and people know who I am. Not to be like those people who are like, "Don't you know who I am?" But
no, I get what you say. I mean, you should own that. You should own that. You are. You're right. You know.
But my point is, BYU has completely shunned me. Here I am, this resource living in the state of Utah, and you know, 5 minutes from the campus, I could.
You should reach out to the kids directly.
They will not touch or have anything to do with me. It's fascinating.
I know how it works. I know. Once you leave, you're like just the black sheep that just you're a dangerous figure now.
I have a theory on this that, and partly driven by my own experience as a Mormon, when you are willing to look at someone else's life whose life doesn't fall in line with what you're told and taught. And you look at their life and you go, wow, they're really happy. They're really successful. Okay. Mm-hmm. They're not living the quote unquote principles that you've been taught. It's acknowledging that is a potential invalidation of your point of view or where you're at, your context. Mm-hmm. That's threatening as a Mormon because everything you've been taught, there's an element of that being an existential threat to who you are as a Mormon and your faith and everything else. So I get it. I get it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the treatment of LGBTQ people, the racism, and then the realization that the Mormon Church is a business, straight up, was also illuminating. Mm-hmm. I didn't read the whole book, but D. Michael Quinn's books on kind of the structure and fundamentals of Mormonism, that was tremendously insightful for me.
Yep.
Illuminating. The fact that the leadership is not transparent at all.
I mean, we all come to the same conclusions. Once you leave, I mean, it's like a never ending discovery journey of what this is really about, which
door,
and we like families and you know, we do good things. Yeah, a lot of people do that, but they don't have that pile of stinky crap under them. That's the problem.
You crack open that door and so much shit just starts falling out.
It's incredible. And it's sad because I say this with in mind a ton of people that I really love and admire that are still very much active. And it works for them. It works for many people. It works for people that I live with that are around me, because if it helps them be better people, fine. Some people are curious and diggers, and I personally wasn't hurt by the church. I don't have a story of racism. I don't have a story of I was treated less than, but I had too many stories around me of people close to me that I started paying attention, and then when I started doing my own research and studying, I discovered, and that in a way, I don't know because I'm not on the other side, but it hurts almost even more because it's really a conscious decision. I could have just pretend nothing of that was there and be still fine. But once you decide to really seek for the truth, it's people who search and seek that come out, like we have, like many millions have now. And are still, it's flooding like every single day. People are leaving because they felt they were lied to. And that is a sad thing.
Sometimes I wonder if that's like buying a car. You know, when you buy a new car and then you see that car everywhere. I forgot, there's actually a technical term for it. I wonder leaving the Mormon Church is a bit like that. Like I see it so much more, so many people leaving.
Well, are there it's not a thing.
I don't know. Because they don't tell us those numbers.
But you know how you know? Is just look at all this Facebook group. And also because I'm also a public person, like directly in regard to that. I have a podcast, I have a, you know, Facebook page. People come to me, people text me, people email me, people say, Hey, I need help. Hey, what's going on? Hey, I'm hurting. And because I've been through it, you know, there was a point where I was like, oh, I really don't want anything to do with it. I'm out. I don't want anything to do. But because it was so painful, as you know, I mean, I don't know how the depths of the pain that you went through, but I went through a real trauma, like when I left. I mean, and I want to say you probably did too, because when something is like part of your life, like, and your conscious and your subconscious, and you have to try to understand, okay, I've been wrong my whole life, pretty much, you know, on that part, not maybe everything, but this was wrong. And this is what I built my life on. There is a whole, you know, reconstruction and recovery, and it's a real trauma. I mean, it's real PTSD. It's real. I felt it in my bones. I lost weight. I wow. went through the whole thing. I mean, it was super traumatic. It wasn't progressive with me so much. It was almost like a overnight realization. It was, you know, more painful than my divorce. It was, you know, I wouldn't say more painful than losing my mother. Nothing has been so far more painful than that. But the pain was real. I mean, it's just, and so now because of it, I do feel like, you know what, I can't turn my head away from someone who's telling me, hey, what's going on? What do I do? You know, because I've been outspoken about it.
You know, it's interesting you talk about the pain of leaving. It wasn't so much, I've never, in my process, I haven't felt anger or rage or anything like that.
Wow, that's good.
I'm grateful I've been able to just let go. And I'm thankful that I was able to leave in my 30s. So even though I spent a large portion of my life in it, the last 4 years have been just amazing for me. Like I mentioned, with design and believing in myself, just really coming into my own and shedding one belief system and then choosing to believe in myself. Because the other aspect of Mormonism is that so much of it's externalized in terms of your validation dependence on guidance or your perception of self or your relationship. So much of it will kneecap you, take you out
You know, because you kind of have to all be the same, right? You know, and they do the same thing with their own. I don't know if you noticed, but the general authorities, like, you know, Sherry Du became someone, I don't know if you knew her, but then Uchtdorf became a little too popular, and then they kind of bring demoted you back down. It's like no, people are gonna like who they're gonna like, and let them shine, you know, like they are. Because he was more, you know, he was a real hope for a lot of people, like me when I was still believing. I'm like, he's European, he gets it, he gets that we can't be so extreme, and you know, we need to be a little more open and stuff like that. But then they quickly kind of like put them back in the shadow, so that everybody's the same, you know, we're all minions and we all follow like little soldiers.
It's a very confusing faith, because the double speak is just so heavy. You can think for yourself and choose for yourself only if it's what we agree.
Yes. Yeah. It's so messed
anything
up.
Anything outside of that, no fucking way.
Yes.
So it's so messed up.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Face Transition Podcast with Spencer Nugent. Stay tuned for the next episode where we will continue this conversation. Feel free to get a hold of Spencer on any of the platforms I've listed in the notes where you can reach him. If you enjoy the podcast, I would love it if you left a review on iTunes and let me know what your thoughts. Feel free also to reach out to me if you have questions, suggestions, or have ideas of what you'd like to hear. This is the Face Transition Podcast. My name is Juliana, and I will see you next time.